Next speaker, we're delighted to have Alexandra Kent, who was once of this parish, but now is in Keele University. Alexandra, over to you.
Thanks, Charles. First of all, an apology. I was going to have handouts for you with the transcripts on so you could see what I was talking about. A printer failure this weekend has meant that doesn't happen. So I'm sorry for the extracts where I'm only playing the video. I don't have the transcript on the screen. Some of them I've got both, so we'll have to get through that. I've been working for quite a few years now on family mealtime directives, so telling the child what to do. Taking a very loose definition of directives, utterances designed to get someone to do something. So not just imperatives, but the whole gambit of trying to get people to do something. There's the early work by sort of Irving Tripp, kind of realm of things, showing some of the variety of formats used to get someone to do something, and some of the early predictions were that social distance or power could be predictors for why you'd use more forceful formulations. But some of the more recent work, and particularly interaction-based work, has shown that there are some very locally relevant factors and interactional factors that can also have a lot of implications for why a particular directive format gets used. So what I want to do today is sort of run through two different sort of ways of explaining, I guess, different formats that I saw in the data. I don't have a particular conclusion to come to because I've sort of got these two different ways of explaining it, and now I'm going, well, what do I do with these two different ways of showing it? How do they relate to each other? Is it useful to have different ways of explaining it? So any help with that quandary would be very useful. The point that I started at was building on from the entitlement and contingency work that Curl and Drew and Gina Heinemann and Lee Smith and Anna Lindstrom as well have looked at in request formats, which is sort of the degree to which you expect the action to be performed, the level to which you can expect the recipient to do what you've asked, told, suggested, hinted happens. So that's the entitlement side of it. And then the contingency side of it is an acknowledgement of things that might get in the way, things that might stop the recipient doing what you're trying to get them to do. And the suggestion from Curl and Drew is that you can distinguish request forms along this continuum of entitlement and contingency, where at the high entitlement end, there's pointedly no orientation to contingencies. They're just not even put on the table as a possibility. This is going to happen, I'm expecting you to do it, do it. So I started with that and then tried to apply it to the directives in the family meal times. A whole range of directive strategies were there. We had some very gentle noticings.
He's still got some beans left up again.
That's one of the ones where I'm afraid I don't have a transcript for you, but Mum says, you've still got some beans left, haven't you? Anna is three. She's a little three-year-old, and the response that she comes up with is, don't want a beans. Mm. She knows this isn't a naive noticing. She knows this is a push towards, these beans need to be eaten. And she's right on the ball with, I don't want to eat my beans. But it's a very gentle way of trying to get someone to do something in terms of just noticing, you've still got some beans left. There's no, you should eat your beans. There's no, I want you to eat your beans. There's just some beans here. And Anna picks up on exactly what the problem is with eating the beans, which is that she doesn't want to eat them. In this family.
Can you finish your fish, please?
So there we've got something that's a little bit more entitled. Dad is asking this time, can you finish your fish, please? That's more typical. There were lots and lots of directives formulated with a can you or a will you modal. So there is at least an orientation there to ability or willingness as a potential contingency. But sort of the steer towards this is what I want you to do is much clearer in the can you finish your fish than it was in the you've still got some beans left, haven't you? What I also had, and this was the subject of the paper that I wrote with Jonathan in 2010, was if the parent didn't get the response they wanted, they tended not to just give up. They tried again and again and again. And I was interested in the successive, the differences between a first directive, a second directive, a third directive, addressing the same action. So this is an example of one of those. I'm sorry it is a little bit blurry, but we've got two girls. Their heads have kind of merged into one here. We've got Kath here and Anna here, and this is the mum. And the issue is where they're going to sit. I do have the transcript for this one afterwards.
Are you lying to me, please? Don't be horrible. Come on, speak back, please. Would you be kind to your sister? I do it down the front. There you go.
Okay, so it starts with, Catherine, can you move along a little bit, please? So we've got the can you, orienting to abilities, possibly willingness. Can you move along a little bit, please? There are some minimizers in there. It's just a little bit. It's not a massive amount of movement that mum's looking for. Just a little, can you move along a little bit, please? And as mum's doing that, she starts to move the chair next to Catherine. In response to, can you move along a little bit, please? Catherine deliberately moves her legs into the path of the chair. So in the spot where doing what you've been asked to do is relevant, Catherine deliberately does something that's counter to what mum's trying to do. We can take that as a pretty clear indication of resistance. Catherine's not planning to go along with this. And you do then get the account at the same time. I want to sit on my own. She wants to sit on her own side of the table. She wants Anna around the other side, not next to her. That's what this whole issue is. So like we had with the can you finish your fish extract, we've got a can you directive followed with an expression of wants. I don't want to eat my fish, or I want to sit on my own. So in a context where you've oriented, where in the directive you've oriented to ability, willingness, you get the response of what the willingness is. In this case, I want to sit on my own. Mum's having none of that. She breaks in to Catherine's slightly whiny, I want to sit on my own, with Catherine, don't be horrible, come on, move back, please. Which is a lot more forceful. There's no, can you do this? There's no little bit in here. First of all, there's the don't be horrible. So we've got a characterisation of what Catherine is doing as a horrible thing to do. We've got come on. I'd love to find the time to look at come on in more detail, because it's not this nice gentle encouragement. It seems to be indexing. There is something that's on the table that is not done, that should be done. So that in itself seems to have this role of sort of ramping up the not done nature, and therefore mum's entitlement to get it done. It should have been done, it hasn't been done. Come on, do it. And now, move along a little bit, please, has been truncated down to move back, please, and converted into a more imperative format. Can you has gone, would you like to, is not in there at all. Mum's not asking anymore, she's telling. So there's a strong upgrade of mum's entitlement to control what Catherine's doing, and there's no longer any acknowledgement of potential contingencies, ability or willingness to do what she's told. And she starts pushing the chair towards Catherine. She then pushes Catherine herself back, so there is now space for this chair. At which point Catherine starts crying. She moves the other chair into position, picks Anna up, sits her on her chair. Catherine's still crying, so we get the, you need to be kind to your sister. And you then get this final one. Now move your legs round to the front. As she actually does move Catherine's legs round. Catherine doesn't even have an option not to comply at this point. Mum is physically moving her into position. So if we're talking about entitlement to control someone else's actions, physically moving them is probably about a limit case of the entitlement that you can claim. You're not just ordering them to do it, you're physically taking control of them and doing it for them. So that sort of shows the kind of ramping up that happens in these successive directives. And that was the typical upgrade pattern. They tended to go in the same way. And if we go back to the examples that we had at the beginning, the beans.
We've still got some beans left, haven't you?
So we're noticing you've still got some beans left, haven't you? Don't want a beans. Mum then comes back with, you've to eat some beans. You've got this upgrade. And with the finished fish.
Can you finish your fish, please?
I don't
want. Don't care. Finish your fish.
I'm just going to put a piece of fish between these two.
And that's a really clear example of what this upgrading the entitlement does. Their dad is making explicit, I don't care about your abilities, your wants, your desires, they are not relevant. I want this action done. Finish your fish. So that's what I sort of saw as happening in these multiple directive sequences. With the successive directives, there was an increased display of entitlement to expect the recipient to comply. And it changed from an asking to a telling. I'm not entirely certain how relevant that change is, because it is just a ramping up of an entitlement to control the other person's actions. And there's a decreased, or in the extreme cases, a total removal of contingencies that might prevent the compliance. So there's this successive impinging on the recipient's freedom of action as you go through the sequence. So comparing those choices of directive format, the low entitlement ones to the high entitlement ones, the low entitlement one, you've still got some beans left, haven't you? It's not really claiming any rights over the recipient's conduct. It's not, the control over the actual action lies with the recipient. Mum's not physically pushing beans in Anna's mouth. She's just noticing beans. Anna's got control over how she responds to that. There's a lot of scope to design her response. That scope to design her response preserves her autonomy and her ability to have a stake in the intersubjectivity, in creating a shared understanding of what's going on. But by preserving Anna's autonomy, there's a higher chance of Anna resisting. She has scope to resist, she has scope to refuse to do it. So there's a higher likelihood of the action not getting done. In contrast with the high entitlement ones, claims of full entitlement, assumes control over the action that's being directed. Not always to the extent of physically moving the recipient, but telling them to do it and then they do it. It's taking control over the action and designing it in that way. So it impinges or completely removes the recipient's autonomy. That risks conflict in the interaction with the potential for a total breakdown in intersubjectivity, tears, tantrums, walkouts from the dinner table, the whole gambit. They follow the high entitled directive. You're not going to get a two-year-old screaming and crying from a gentle, you've still got some beans left on your plate. So that's the risk with that one, but you have got a higher chance of the directed action actually getting done. So it's a case of what's being prioritised. Preserving autonomy, nice intersubjectivity, keep the conversation going, or getting the beans eaten, whatever it might be. And that's the first way I approached it. I then went back and took a look at preference organisation. And here Robinson and Boulder's 2010 paper on explicit account solicitations was quite a useful steering point, and they identified a lot of dispreferred first pair parts. There's less that's been done on first pair parts to second pair parts, but you know, the literature is clearly building. There are some first pair parts that are better to do, that happen in a more preferred way than others. The key finding that Robinson and Bolden came up with was that systematic feature of dispreferred first pair parts is that they're withheld relative to the first point they could have relevantly been performed. So they're delayed in the interaction. And from looking at the data that I've just shown you, highly entitled directives are recurrently delayed in favour of less entitled formulations. You don't start with the move your legs around to the front. That's what you build up to. So there's evidence that those really highly entitled forms are being delayed, and perhaps therefore dispreferred. The problem that I've got is that highly entitled directives don't exclusively occur in these long extended sequences. There are plenty of examples where it's the first attempt, where an imperative formulation or some strongly entitled way of getting someone to do it is the first go. So I wanted to see how that would fit in with the assertion that the more highly entitled a directive is, the more dispreferred it is. Here's an example of that type of thing.
Earlier you said you didn't want beer, so Ruby thought you weren't allowed beer. So she said, "Do you want any drinks, didn't you?" You went, "No," and Ruby came up to me and said, "There's beer in, right?"
Ruby, look at what you're doing.
So, sort of cut off the top half of this, because you don't need the whole beer story again. But Daisy's telling quite an extended story about her younger sister's confusion between what alcohol was and what various things it was found in. And while she's doing this, Lucy drops a bit of pasta. It falls off her fork and lands in her lap. And Dad comes in overlap, with Daisy's very last word. He nearly waits for her to finish. Lucy drops the food, as Daisy said, "There's beer." So there's beer in grapes, and it's on the grapes that Dad comes in with, "Lucy, look at what you're doing." A couple of things to note about this one. Firstly is that the directive comes in very soon after the transgression, the thing that Lucy did wrong. It comes in quite quickly after that. But the other point is the fact that it comes in overlap. And it was so close to not being in overlap. You know, if the pasta fell on theirs, you know, the Lucy could have happened, beer in 0.6 second pause, but it's the grapes. And it could have just waited until Daisy had finished her story. So it seems designed to break into the ongoing talk. On your handouts, I did have another example of where the mum designs it to break into her own talk. She's halfway through explaining something to one child, and then she breaks off to tell another child off about something. So these ones seem designed to be interruptive, to be, this has to get fixed now, because it's so important that it gets fixed now. And it's done in this highly entitled way. There's the summons, attention summons to get Lucy. We've got the high volume on look, it's the imperative formulation. So it's a much higher entitled directive than we saw with some of the others. And it seems designed in this very interruptive way. So when the single directives are designed this way, they recurrently do index some aspect of the recipient's immediately prior conduct. Most of the directives in the dinner time data did that, but these interruptive ones did it very close to. They wanted to get it in the same turn. And they break into the ongoing talk to claim that locally occasioned entitlement. What I mean by that is...
Excuse me, there's more on this stoke open, please.
She's
having gone. Oh, right.
So what I'm suggesting happens by breaking into the ongoing talk is that they're done in a high entitlement way, but that entitlement is based on, this is urgent. Something has just happened that has to be dealt with now, and therefore I'm entitled to interrupt, I'm entitled to tell you what to do rather than just ask, because this is really locally occasioned, this is really relevant, and if I wait until you finish this long extended story, Lucy will probably have picked the food up and got back on with what she's doing, and Dad would have missed the opportunity to reprimand her. So by interrupting, they're building a locally occasioned warrant to use a high entitlement for. So by using this highly entitled directive, the first attempt is marked as forceful. It's marked as, this is urgent, this has to be dealt with now, this thing is a big problem that you've just done, it's worth interrupting other stories for, and it's worth doing it in an imperative, forceful way of saying it. So it's more disaffiliative than a, oh Lucy, you just dropped some pasta type way. And if we relate that back to what Robinson and Bolden found with their explicit account solicitations, when those were not withheld, they embodied an aggravated stance of challenge or disaffiliation. So there's the same type of practice happening here. You have a dispreferred action that currently is withheld in interaction in favour of a more preferred version. And when you violate that preference structure, so when you do a dispreferred action without withholding it, it's done in a markedly disaffiliative or challenging way. So the very action of violating the preference structure achieves something. In the case of directives, I suggest it's to get this locally occasioned warrant to boost the entitlement to tell someone what to do. It also displays a marked lack of concern with the recipient's autonomy. It didn't give Lucy time to pick the food up herself and put it back in her bowl or put it on the side. It didn't give her time to self-correct. It just launched straight in there with, look at what you're doing. Don't know why that bit's gone on a separate line. So it's, in terms of this choice between preserving intersubjectivity, building up the recipient's autonomy, or focusing on getting the action done and progressivity in that case, these type of directives, these high entitlement first directives, seem very much skewed towards this action must get done now at all costs, so not the concern to face autonomy, freedom of action, whatever we might want to call that. And that's what I mean by my sort of two different ways of explaining the different directives. It, you know, there's the entitlement and contingency thing, where high entitlement privileges the progressivity of the action, getting the job done above other concerns, risks the breakdown in intersubjectivity, or the low entitlement version that boosts the autonomy but risks not getting it done. And then it can be explained using preference organisation. High entitlement directives are disaffiliative social actions. That's why they're recurrently withheld. And if you don't withhold them, it's marking an utterance as particularly forceful, particularly disaffiliative, particularly concerned with getting the action done. Which is kind of where I got to with this. And I got to this point and I was sort of like, well, is that useful? Is that a helpful way of doing it? Just talking about preference organisation add anything to what I had before? And any feedback on that would be quite helpful.
Thank you very much. Good. Thank you, Alexandra. Plenty of opportunity then to get in there. Yes, Tracy. Tracy, come.
Thanks. That was really interesting talk. One thing I wanted to ask about the end. Can you just put the last slide up for a second? Okay, so on the entitlement and contingency side, I don't really have an answer for you about whether preference organization adds anything to it, but I did think that was a very interesting thing to bring in. And I think also it's and I've wondered this about the data that you look at with the children and the parents versus looking only at adults interacting, which is what we did with the requests. And some of the, with the entitlement and contingency, what you've talked about today has really focused just on the entitlement side of it. And one of the things I wanted to say, and this didn't end up in the first request paper, but it's coming out, it's out in a paper that Paul and Rich and I had in a book that Makoto has just edited, and I can't remember the title of it because I've got a terrible memory. But where we talk about the imperative formatted requests, so your directives, but they don't have to do only with the entitlement, but that they are more indexing really low contingency on the person who's being requested for the thing. So, and it's family meal time again, but it's among adults, and it's pass me this, give me that.
Yeah.
And in those cases, there's actually, it's one of those things where you're like, thank God there's a repair here so I can actually see orientation to it, where there's a bottle of salad dressing, and she starts to ask for it, says, pass me, and cuts off because he moves it. And as he's moving it, she repairs down to a, could you pass the gravy? Mm-hmm. So the way I interpreted that, not thinking about this in terms of a preference organization, was that it's not so much the entitlement always with the format, mm-hmm. but it can be the contingency. And so when the contingency changes, and he's just passed it away, the person she was going to ask for it from, he's just passed it away to someone else, then she has to repair away from the, you know, give me that, because that it's no longer so easy for him. So, in fact, what I'm saying probably just introduces another level of complication to what you're saying, because it you have to consider the entitlement and the contingency, because I think they pull in opposite directions.
Yeah. No, I can definitely see that, and yeah, in most of these ones, contingency is not brought out in the data in the same way, because there is. It is very entitlement focused. There is one that I looked at where the mum is directing, it's actually Laura's data that she kindly shared with me. Mum is directing the son to inject his insulin for diabetes. And the kid's complaint as to why he can't do it is that there are lots of bruises around the injection site. And then mum backs off, looks at the site, makes a judgment call, and then has to ramp up the entitlement in a different way. So yeah, I would say it completely goes along with that interpretation. It's just not shown in this data.
Robert Dingwall, you had a hand up.
No.
Oh, is you pointing at Bill Well? Off you go.
Yes, I think it's sort of touchy on the same thing. What struck me about the last example was that there's two actions going on here. There's the meal, and then there's the storytelling. So there's a kind of competition between the two actions. And I was interested, as you noted, in the placement of the farmer's overlap. We don't know she'd finished it.
No.
And it seemed to me that it was placed at the point where actually it looked as though she might be continuing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering whether it was something about negotiating the relative importance of the two parallel social actions, like the storytelling and the conduct of the meal, which in itself is a collaborative activity. That's how it works.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I tried to do was sort of map the directive sequences in relation to ongoing stories or non-mealtime related talk. And I was hoping I'd find a really neat pattern whereby you had an ongoing story, directive just sort of dipped in, did something, dipped out, and the story carried on. Happens sometimes, but more often than not, the story got lost and it wasn't brought back to afterwards. And yet the directives do jump in that way with apparent disregard for the conversation that's going on. So yeah, I think there is an uneasy tension between all of these different tasks that are happening at the mealtime.
Andrew Barrett.
You might have just said this with the bruises example. You've talked about ramping ups.
Yeah.
Do you ever get ramping downs?
Rarely. I get parents giving up and just neat subject change. You're halfway through a directive sequence, it's not going to happen. Oh, look at this bird outside. Really obvious changes of tact, or allowing one child to distract the other. That tends to happen. It's a case of if the parent's going for it, they will ramp up until it happens, or they'll
abandon.
Give up. I don't tend to see the coming back down, other than in the bruises example where it came back down, but in the end, mum did go back up to, you need to inject. Because Jack's claim was that it was the pen that was causing the bruises, so injecting would hurt whenever he did it. And mum's argument was, no, it's because you're injecting too close to previous injection site. So you can inject, just do it somewhere else. And then she got herself back up to a higher intake.
I was thinking
of a paper
that
was quite
interesting
by Lorraine
Mangada,
where she looks at directives in an environment where you have contingency and urgency all together, which is young adults playing video games.
Okay.
And basically the guys are going, shoot it, do it now, kind of things to various degrees. but it brings all of these issues together.
Oh, okay.
Where you have the urgency element that sort of strips away some of the contingency
yeah.
elements, but sometimes it's oriented to as well when the game is calming down a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So you might want to look at that.
Yeah. No,
I'll
just
that.
Thank you.
The last question. Good. Excellent. Thank you once again.